just relaxing into where we are and what we're doing. All of us have multiple threads of energy pulling us in lots of directions, perhaps even urgent seeming crisis oriented threads pulling us, or griefs or distresses that are seemingly difficult to resolve. For the next hour and a half or so that we're together, there's nothing that can be done directly about anything that's outside this room. But we can, in fact, quite positively affect the outcome of all that concerns us by using this time to align ourselves with a greater reality, with a greater creativity, with the possible solutions that superconsciousness can bring. The extent to which this time will be transformative, informative, uplifting, a future potential benefit, is really in our hands together, greatly dependent upon the degree to which we open ourselves to an understanding we don't already have, to an intuition waiting to be awakened, to an energy of our own understanding that is there for us to realize. So let us turn all of this into a heartfelt inner affirmation of receptivity, an inner prayer of openness, that we may together magnetize to ourselves wisdom and blessings and joy. Let's be quiet now for a moment. Om peace. Amen. You know, this is a bit of a difficult topic because I feel very tall in relation to today. Do you mind if I sit down? You just somehow feel like it's a more intimate group. Yeah, that's better. If you need to adjust your chairs now that I'm sitting down, please just move your chairs around. It's a small room if you want to be more visible. I don't think there's anyone living who really has clear sailing unless you're a highly evolved spiritual person. The nature of human life is just that we struggle. Swami Kriyananda, who's my teacher, his picture is there in the white book. He's an American man. He passed away a year and a half ago, April of 2013. But I knew him for the last 45 years. He was an American man with an Indian name, and he was a disciple of Paramahansa Yogananda, whose picture is in the middle. His book, Yogananda's book, Autobiography of a Yogi, is a seminal spiritual book. If you haven't read that book, I highly encourage you to. Almost everyone who starts on a personal spiritual journey ends up reading Yogananda's book. Yogananda died in 1952. Kriyananda was a direct disciple. Myself and others who follow that teaching had to get it the next generation down rather than direct. The teachings of Yogananda are orthodox Indian teaching, not Hinduism, but the teaching of India, which is the true word for that is Sanatana Dharma, which means simply the eternal truth. Religion is an overlay on the eternal truth, and all religions are overlaid over the same eternal truth. People use the word Sanatana Dharma in India inaccurately now, but that doesn't matter. And the eternal truth is very simple, which is that our Our experience of life is generated from within. And even though we get the impression that our experience of life is dependent on the circumstances of our life, the actual Sanatana Dharma is that our inner consciousness is the determining factor of what we experience, and that inner consciousness is under our control. Now, these are not truths that are self-evident to everyone, and even after you understand them theoretically, there is a lot of effort that has to be put in until that theoretical understanding is translated into something that you can actually use every day. I was 22 years old, actually living right in this area, when Swami Kriyananda came to give a lecture at Stanford University in the year 1969. I was knowledgeable at that point of the theory that reality emanated from inside ourselves. And one of the ways that I really understood that is that I'd had an experience with hallucinogenic drugs, which was something that was happening at that time. I was by no means a committed drug user, but it was very hard to go through those years without at least touching into it. Some people did, but I didn't. I touched into it. But it didn't require very many drug experiences for me to learn essentially the one thing it had to teach me, which is if you change your inner reality, absolutely everything else changes. I wasn't a person who drank. I mean, I had never had a beer before I had a hallucinogenic drug, and I never took hardly anything after that, because it told me the one thing that I really wanted to know, which I had been desperately wanting to know, which is, how do I gain mastery over the life I'm living? Because I felt so much just that I was the victim of circumstances. Everybody's answer to my fundamental query of how am I supposed to live, what is the purpose of life, was to do something external. Get good grades in high school, go to a good college, pick a career that, you know, that primarily will be lucrative, but maybe incidentally you might like it. Then try to get a job and try to find a husband and try to have children and buy a house in a good real estate market and whatever it might be. But I was asking questions that were really about how I would feel in the midst of all those experiences, and all people were answering me was how to have those experiences. And there always seemed to be a fundamental disconnect that I couldn't get anybody to pay attention to. And growing up in a Western culture like this one, especially at the time, coming of age in the 60s, was when a whole new way of looking at life burst open, and drugs were a part of that, even though they weren't really what you should say, an essential part of it, but they were a catalyzing part of it because of that one factor. I put this chemical into my body, and it did this really weird thing to my brain, which I really was not anxious to repeat because I like my brain like it is, and I didn't really enjoy having my brain invaded that way. And so I never really sought those experiences of drinking or drugs or anything very much afterwards. But I saw that when my inner reality shifted, and because of the way the drugs worked at that time, the inner reality shifted as to show you that much of what we were looking at was not what it seemed. And this was basic physics already. Einstein had already brought it out, but it wasn't as all pervasively understood that really it's all in your point of view. And once I got that it was all in my point of view, and that, look, just this little pill could just make this whole world look transparent and under my control, and just everything was different, I became obsessed with the idea of consciousness. And I was in college at that time, and I took a class on consciousness, thinking that they would answer for me the question I wanted to ask, which is, how do I influence the quality of my own consciousness? That seemed to me the only question worth asking. And instead, I found myself in this extremely dull conversation about everybody's opinion about what consciousness was. I didn't really care what people's opinion about consciousness was. I wanted to know how to walk the path between misery and happiness and find the one that led me to happiness. Isn't that what everyone wanted? And I was so bewildered to discover that it wasn't. But a few years later, not too many years later, Swami Kriyananda walked into my life. And what he brought into the room was a different consciousness. It was like everybody I knew was more or less the same. Some people were more cheerful than others. Some were being inclined to be depressed. Some were worriers. Some were codependents. People were all different kinds of things. But we were all essentially in it together. And then I saw Swami Kriyananda walk into the room, and he hadn't even spoken. I felt it vibrationally. He just brought a completely different consciousness into the room. And I had been reading about what he manifested, because what he manifested was an inner self-mastery that made him independent of his circumstances in a way that I knew was theoretically possible, but I'd never seen expressed. And as soon as I saw it, I just knew that I needed to learn what he knew. And he was the first person, including my professors at Stanford where I was a student, who actually had something that I actually wanted. I had plenty of intelligence, but I didn't have that self-mastery. And from that day, November in 1969, to sitting right here, this has been my priority. Lots of other really interesting things have happened to me along the way. I've traveled a lot. I've been part of an interesting lifestyle experiment, which is the Ananda Communities. I've met and lived with married a wonderful man and had a lovely life with him. But the unifying thread of all of that has been that whatever we're experiencing outwardly is a challenge and therefore an opportunity to work on and develop our inner consciousness. And all spiritual teaching, no matter how it's couched, whether it's shamanism where we're trying to work with the nature spirits or the natural world and trying to gain mastery and power over that, whether it's meditation, whether it's centering prayer, whether it's the rituals of Hinduism or the traditions of Judaism, the point of all of it is that somehow or another we want to align ourselves with a vibration that actually brings us what? Peace, happiness, courage, faith, power. We have all kinds of words that we might use for it, but if you trace it back to its source, it all has to do with how we respond to the circumstances and the conditions of our lives, and whether or not we are just subject to what happens to us, or whether we can either influence what happens to us, or if that is beyond our control for many reasons that it could be, that we are in charge of how we respond. Now, to me, that should be what we start learning in kindergarten, and we should learn it all the way through to the day we take our last breath. Fortunately, a teeny weeny bit of this is coming into the educational system. Ananda itself, which is the network of communities that I'm a part of that Swami Kriyananda founded. We have a community and a temple right here in Palo Alto. In fact, East West Bookstore is a project of Ananda. It's an independent entity, but it's our project, the universality of all teachings and providing a forum for all opportunities to advance spiritually and in other ways is a project that's dear to our heart. We run our own schools also. Here our school goes to the 8th grade. In some other places our schools go all the way through high school, and we even run a small college. The basic premise of our schools is that information is only of value if you have the inner discipline and the understanding to know how to use it. Nowadays, the practical side of life, even right here in Silicon Valley, is catching up to that. There was a major executive on the radio who was asked, you know, what do you look for in employees? Creativity, adaptability, cooperation, concentration. He was asked, you know, what qualifications do you look for? He said, well, this week I hired 6 employees. He said, I can't remember what company he was speaking for. 2 had a PhD. 2 had a college degree. I think one of those college degrees had something to do with the job he was doing. The other was irrelevant. 2 of them were high school dropouts. But all of them had the qualities that he knew were needed in order to be a success in his business. It's a very changing world that we're working in. So when we educate our children, which we do very conscientiously, so that they can exist well in this world, how they learn is as essential to what they learn, because things are changing so fast that what you learn is disappearing before you can even get into any practical application of it. Starting with the map of the world, what to speak of science and technology. So how you learn is really what you need to succeed in life, the ability to learn. One child who, this was years ago, went through our junior high school, and then she went on to this was in Nevada City with the community I used to live in. Then she went on to the high school, public high school. I saw a notice in our community newsletter that she was on the honor roll, and I congratulated her. She laughed. She says it's effortless to get on the honor roll at this high school. She said the only thing they want to know is the answers to the questions. They don't care. She said when I was at the Ananda school, they cared about, you know, how happy I was doing it, whether I was concentrated and efficient, whether I was creative in my responses, whether I was moody, whether I was helpful to the other children. And she just went on like this. She said, I could be Satan himself, she says, in this school. It makes no difference as long as I answer the questions properly. She says it's effortless compared to what real education is about. Now, all of us are the ill fruit of being raised without any understanding of what we really need to live, which is, well, the topic for tonight. When trouble comes, what do we do? And that trouble can come in the form of catastrophe, you know, the death or loss of people who are really, really close to us, a complete betrayal by people that we trusted, a sudden economic shift, a loss of our livelihood, and in this economy, a difficult certainty as to whether it will ever be restored. Sudden diagnosis of serious health problems. You know, a dear friend of mine, you know, she's waiting with Thanksgiving dinner a year ago, or perhaps it was probably a year ago now. And instead of her son coming home, she gets a call from the police. He's never coming home. He's gone to the other side, just like that. You know, the whole family is just fractured, just like that. We can say, oh, dear God, please not me. But there's no guarantee. And it's naive to imagine that we will be spared. Or even if we don't have dramatic catastrophe, life progresses. And most people do not become lighter and happier as they get older. I mean, there's a few exceptions that do. But most people become smaller and more fatigued. It's just what we see. I mean, that's what old age looks like. I mean, yes, we think it looks like the hair turns gray or the skin wrinkles, but what it really looks like is fatigue and discouragement. And people can be quite old when they're quite young. And these are serious troubles. So I think what we have to do is we have to revamp entirely the way that we're living. We can't really just sort of put a Band-Aid over this. I've been teaching the spiritual path seriously for decades now, really 40 years maybe. And I've traveled a good bit and taught in a number of countries. I only speak English, so I haven't been everywhere by any means, but I've been in other cultures enough. And here you just have to sit in one place and you're talking to all cultures. And the spiritual path that I follow is not a quick fix. That's the only answer that I can say. It's a serious step-by-step transformation that when it comes is permanent, but it's not one dramatic weekend and you have a big breakthrough and then you're somebody else. And it deals very seriously with karma and past lives and the energies we've set in motion and the wrong thoughts that we have and the gradual turning them around. I've been asked repeatedly, I'll just say. I would almost go to say it's virtually in every class, and twice today via email. a question that comes in many, many, many forms. But when you boil it down, even if you translate it from another language, the question is, isn't there an easier way? You know, I do this, I do that, I've read this, I've read that, but how do I really solve these problems? How do I really become free and easy, and how do I not suffer? Today I was asked, my common expectations are regularly disappointed. How do I not be upset about that? I said, well, this is the spiritual path. This is the Bhagavad Gita. This is the Bible. This is every master who ever lived. How do I gain self-mastery and become free inside? So the first thing you have to understand is this is the pearl of great price. And tonight I'm only going to point you in the right direction. I cannot really make your life different, but I hope that I can help you to understand that your life can be different, and therefore we need to begin. So let's start with a few very simple premises. You know, what is the actual nature of life, and what can we really expect? There's a great epic tale in India called the Mahabharata, and I won't give you the whole story, but the point here is there's one little dramatic point in which everything seems to be lost, and this one hero has the chance to answer a few questions correctly, and then everything will turn again to the good, which of course it does. And one of the questions he's asked is, what is the most remarkable thing about human life? And he answers without hesitating, oh, that all around us people see that everyone dies, and then everyone thinks it will never happen to me. And the corollary of that is that we don't think deeply about why we're even here. You know, the fact that everyone dies, and we like to think that we'll die at a ripe old age, contented and happy, and that everybody we love will not die an untimely death, and it'll all just work out neatly. But we have to ask ourselves even the question seriously, is that the point? Is the point of life to actually just be one of the lucky ones who just skates through? Is it a successful life if we're never challenged? Now, think about that for a minute. Like, what is the reason we're here? My friend, when she was trying to train her 2-year-old boy to be potty trained, and he was extremely disinterested in the project, and she finally tried to use that major incentive that mothers use on little boys, and she said, "Don't you want to be a big boy?" And he looked at her absolutely astonished and said, "No, Mommy, I like being a baby." Just like that. Which was at least a very, very honest answer. And it told her exactly where she was with him, which is, it's not time yet to try this. Okay. Now, compared to men and women of true wisdom, what to speak of those individuals of true enlightenment who come back on this planet and try to teach us, we ask them, how can I get money, get children, get the spouse, get the job, get the this, get the that, get this, get this, get this, get this? And the saints look at us and say, don't you want to be a big boy, a big girl? Don't you really want to become mature and grown up? Do you really want to fulfill your inner destiny? And our answer essentially most of the time is no, I would rather be a baby. I would rather just be taken care of and have everything given to me just the way I think it ought to be given. Because the other part of a real relationship to life, if we're honest, now I'll back this up just a little bit. Starting in 1986, for about 20 years, every year or every other year, my husband and I and another couple who are friends of ours were in charge of leading pilgrimage trips to India. Paramhansa Yogananda, who I mentioned earlier, autobiography of a yogi. He was born in Bengal. He grew up in India, and the autobiography takes place almost entirely in India, and there's many holy sites related to that book and as a consequence to our spiritual path. And he had this brainy idea, and it was both a business plan and a good idea spiritually, that we would take groups mostly of Americans, people who are dedicated to the spiritual path or at least interested in it. We would take them to India, and we would travel around for like 28 days over that very large country and go to many spiritual places. India, since that time, almost 30 years now, has transformed phenomenally. But then especially, and still now, it's a difficult country to travel in. And even for the spiritual seeker, it's hard to get really focused energy because it's a very chaotic place. So it was a very popular idea. And over the course of those years, we took hundreds by the end of people, mostly going to India for the first time, mostly going out of the Western context for the first time. Now, in the country of India, even now, but especially then, you see lots of conditions that you just don't see here. The cities are all being cleaned up and people are being helped, but then there was a lot more people sleeping on the street, living on the sidewalk, beggars, injured people, children, beggars, just a lot of chaos. Overpopulation is just a theory until you go to a place that's overpopulated, then the stark reality comes to you. So many people were anxious about how they would deal with, primarily they would think of it in terms of poverty, how they would deal emotionally with that poverty. And my job on that trip was mostly just with the people, to keep people's spirits up, to keep their spiritual focused, and to take them through whatever opportunities for growth were offered. So I had to work with many people who became emotionally distressed at walking out of the Grand Hotel in Calcutta and just being surrounded by beggars who are demanding money from you, walking along the ghats in Varanasi and having merchants just trailing you who would not give up to have you buy some cheap and cheesy object that they were determined to sell, and you felt that whether they ate that night or not was dependent on whether you bought that cheesy object, and it was stressful. And over time, I began to see a very interesting pattern develop, which is some people, and I have to count myself among them, I'm a very compassionate person, but I just saw the conditions around me and just accepted them as the conditions around me and did not find myself unduly unsettled by it. And, you know, some percentage of our group would just respond just exactly as I did. Others would become so tense about it. And I began gradually to see that there was a very consistent predictor factor in how people would develop. You look out, and the reason that you feel so distressed is you think these people are suffering. And of course, on a certain level, they are suffering. I mean, in the Grand Hotel in Calcutta, I could look down from my beautiful room, and there was a family living on the sidewalk. And we were there for 5 days. And in the course of 5 days, I could watch them come and go and cook their meals and sleep and wake up. You know, and I'm so comfortable, and there they are living on the sidewalk. I looked down because I was in the upstairs room looking down. So we imagine that that is a terrible existence. And to a certain extent, there is a lot of misery in it. There's no denying that. I'm not going to say poor people are happy or everyone in India is happy. That's of course not true. But the factor about whether you could handle it or not is whether or not, as an individual, you have accepted that suffering is often a necessary stage to growth, and that sometimes the most difficult challenges have in the end proved to be the most beneficial if we think of the purpose of life to be ever-expanding awareness, to be an ever-expanding sense of embracing the world and life around us, an ever-expanding sense of self-definition, a greater sense of personal confidence and self-mastery, that conditions do not have to determine my reality, but that I can face into them. But most of all, that suffering is often a necessary stage to personal growth. And invariably, when people became very upset that other people were living difficult lives, it always traced back to the fact that they were very much either in rebellion, in denial, or in a constant state of anxiety about what difficulties they might have to face in their life. Just a line like that. Now, if we think that the whole purpose of life is to just be comfortable and be challenged as little as possible, sure, any hardship that comes to us is a total pointless freak out, isn't it? And just something to just be beaten down and escaped as soon as possible, if necessary, by drinking every night so we don't have to think about it. Which, of course, sets in motion an entirely new host of problems, but in the meantime, it looks like a solution. That's why people drink, watch television, overeat, take too much sugar, drink, take drugs, whatever, or even in the worst case, kill themselves. It's just like, if I can just escape this experience, everything will be fine. But factor in reincarnation, which has to be factored in, because nothing works if we just go from birth to death. I mean, this can be a different conversation when I invite your questions, but factor in the possibility that the one incarnation that we presently know about is a chapter in a big book, and that by no means did we start when we were born, and we certainly don't end when we die. There's been so much evidence in the last decades, you know, it's a point that hardly has to be argued, no matter how clearly you perceive it, certainly there's more happening than just what we perceive. Let's imagine that incarnations are continuous. The Dalai Lama was once asked a question about reincarnation. Was it the Dalai Lama? I'm not certain. I just don't want to take credit for a good answer that I didn't invent. And he was asked something about reincarnation, and he gave a fascinating answer, whoever it was. They said, "You think of each incarnation as being this discrete, separate event." He says, "In fact, all of your incarnations are a continuous reality. You do change in and out of bodies, and then you go into a body that's just a baby's body, so you have to relive all those stages. But from infancy, from conception, your full intelligence and your full consciousness is there. It just is. I've never been pregnant, but every woman I know who's been pregnant, especially more than once, tells you babies are different. They're different in the womb. And they're different as soon as they pop out, and they're different as soon as they start acting. And it's not explainable. I mean, in the same family, even twins, they can just be so different from one another because it's not a clean slate. I mean, if you think about now, because of the internet, we get to see all these amazing, what can only be evidences of reincarnation, whatever you call them, because of the internet and because of these apparently all over the world, these We Got Talent contests. So you have all these remarkable people. The most remarkable one I saw recently was like an 8 or 9 year old girl, maybe she was 10, and she was singing opera. She'd never had a lesson in her life. She'd merely listened to records and learned to sing. And she wasn't merely good. She had the fully mature voice with all the emotional and vibrational overtones of a highly developed female soprano. And it was just unquestionable that this woman had worked her whole previous incarnation to get that voice, and she just darn well wasn't going to lose it. And she just held it somehow by her willpower. She brought it right into that body. And as soon as she was old enough to turn on the record player herself, she started recreating who she was. And, you know, there's many other examples, but she was the most recently entertaining one to me. Because it wasn't just a child singing. Well, this was completely different. This was like she was inhabited by a full-grown artist. And she even talked about how when she would stand, she would often just imagine herself in front of hundreds of fans, thousands of fans, all past life memories. But for us, too, and more importantly, I mean, that talent, developing talent is one thing. But what we're really developing is our consciousness, our ability to cope, our happiness, our self-awareness. And we work and we accomplish to a certain degree, and then we're born and we continue. So what that also means is you never get to escape. You never get to just die with a really stinky, angry attitude about something and then never have to pay it off. You always have to pay it off because it stays with you. The karma, that's what karma is. It just stays with you. So why are we here? What are we trying to learn? And what is our full potential? Is physical comfort and wealth and admiration from others, is that our full potential as a human being? Or is perfect love, perfect joy, perfect self-offering, in other words, the lives of the saints and the enlightened one, is that our destiny? And if so, how are we going to get there? And that's what all the scriptures are all about. That's what they all tell us. Autobiography of a Yogi, the book I wrote about Swami Kriyananda, even Miracles and Answered Prayers. The other book, what are we doing here? So, first we have to believe that that's the purpose. And then that gives us a very different attitude, you see, when something difficult happens. Instead of suddenly feeling like we've been punished and we just have to outlast it, we suddenly have the opportunity to think, how can I use this to develop myself? How can I face whatever karmic challenge this actually is and meet it in such a way that I can put it behind me? The way Swami Kriyananda talked about it once is that when an energy wave of karma hits you, let's say it's this big, the opportunity for us is to expand our awareness so that we are bigger than that wave of karma and that we can absorb it. Let's use very challenging examples. Let's say we've been married for a long time and all of a sudden our spouse just decides not to be married to us anymore. And all of a sudden from a comfortable, let's say, protected life, we suddenly have the opportunity to live in uncongenial places and have to reestablish ourselves financially and socially in a way that we never wanted to do. So that's the wave of karma. And we've just defined ourselves in this particular way. And suddenly that wave of karma demands that we let go of many, many habits, self-identities, securities, self-definitions, self-esteem. We have to let go of all of that and literally expand our awareness to include dimensions of ourselves that we were never going to bother to find anything found out about and hope just to drift through and never know about. So this is the karma. That's the challenge. So if we have the capacity to at least come close, if not to completely embrace what's come to us, look how big we've become. Would we ever have done that if this wave didn't hit us? Is the result of having to expand ourselves something that we have actually, now we really have it? It's not just the comfort of having a spouse who made everything easy for us, but now this is our actual knowledge of ourself. And when you die, your comfortable home, your loving spouse, all the money in the bank, all of it, gone. You don't carry any of that over to the next world, nothing. All that you take with you is your own consciousness. Everything that you have become goes with you. It is the only lasting possession that we ever have. And then when our next incarnation starts, we don't start with the husband, the money, the inherited wealth, whatever it is. We start with who we are vibrationally, in our consciousness and in our awareness. Now, I think that's something worth working on in your life, don't you? Everybody dies, but nobody thinks it's going to happen to them. And few people think about what that actually means. I mean, for myself personally, it was one of the primary reasons why I got on the spiritual path. I was 18. I was actually a seeker all the way through, but I remember when I was 18 thinking really seriously about death. I wasn't morbid, I didn't think I was going to die tomorrow, but I had already noticed that it's always now. That odd sort of thing, it's always now. And that when I was, everybody always thinks they're going to be 85 when they die, when I was 85, I was then 18. I knew when I was 85, it would come and it would be now. And when it was now, and the last breaths would come, that it was utterly inescapable. And absolutely nothing that I did between now and then would change that last breath and the absolute solitude of it. I wasn't thinking about relationship with God. I was just thinking that, you know, no matter how many husbands or children or friends I have, that's going to be just me and my own consciousness at that point. And I actually remember I was awake all night. Whether I literally was or not, I don't know. But I projected in my imagination, projected myself into every conceivable situation I could imagine, including getting in a spaceship and going to other planets, living as a colonist on the moon, traveling to every country in the world, everything, but nothing could change the absolute solitude of that moment. And it seemed to me important at that point that I do something between now and then that bore some relationship to that. In other words, what is of lasting value? What will make my life really worthwhile when I get there? And this is where, when everybody told me just accumulate, I just thought, why? But then when I understood, oh, accumulate expansive consciousness, accumulate an inner independence from circumstances. And then gradually I began to understand independence even, you see, from the life or death of the body. The movies all give us this marvelous picture now, and so do all these death and return books, don't they? Bodies die, go into comas, go into states of shock, stop breathing, hearts beat, and people discover that nothing has happened to them. They transition to these other realms, but they're essentially the same, and they're in the other realms, they're working out the same stuff that they were working out when they were here. These are true stories. These are consistent with all the masters. So, here we are. Karma comes, and it asks us to be bigger than we were. So, what do we do? Now, what most people do is they hunker down, and they outlast it. And what happens is with any wave, if you think of a wave, has a certain height, and then over time, it gets smaller. So, most of the time, people hunker down, and they wait until the karmic wave becomes smaller than they are. And then they say they've gotten over it. But of course, the next time it hits, where are we? Have we changed? And that attitude of not rising to it is the attitude of, I am a victim, it's somebody else's fault, God, there is no God, and this is just a horrible world, they're at fault, they have to do something for me, the government needs to fix it, why don't these people change their attitude? And you know, these are all responses. They have a certain internal logic, but where does it leave you? You see, it's a question of pragmatism. I'm a very practical person. What will really make a difference? You know, what power is there? Do I belong to a greater reality? And can the power of that greater reality be drawn into me and give me a strength to be able to move through this? How much do I want to grow? How free do I really want to be? I noticed a peculiarity in my youth when I was 18, 19 years old, that I wanted to be happy, and everybody I knew wanted to be happy. But there was a peculiarity about me, which is that I actually understood that in order to be happy, I had to change myself. And I observed that everybody around me, mostly who wanted to be happy, wanted somebody else to change. You know, they wanted the man they were in love with to love them back, even though he didn't. They wanted the mother who had never taken proper care of them to suddenly become somebody she was never going to be. You know, they wanted it to be okay to go out and get drunk every night and then just not have a hangover the next morning. You know, just, they wanted good grades in school without ever really studying and learning how to concentrate. But I tended to look at things and ask myself, if it's out of my control, which almost everything is really, then the only thing I actually can shift is me. And I'm willing to be different. If he's not in love with me, I'm going to stop hanging around here waiting for him to love me. Like, how's that going to help? You know, and if I don't do the work, what do you know? I don't get the grades. Just as simple as that. So the first thing is not to be a victim. The second thing is not to think that somebody's going to do it for you. And another point is simply, reality has to be dealt with. You know, we have to really have the courage to just say, this is what is happening. And get out of the fact that we think that reality is going to conform to what we want. And that if we just keep denying that it's happening, that somehow it's not really happening. And then to understand that everything can be turned to good depending on how we respond. Because everything is an opportunity for greater self-mastery for greater personal power, for greater growth, for greater relationship and devotion to a higher power, for a greater opportunity to live more in an expanded realm than a narrow one. This book here, Loved and Protected, is stories I collected from people, which are just amazing stories. I mean, some of them are amazing in external ways. All of them were amazing for me, gathering them. Because in every case, somebody had faced something that challenged them, and they had tuned into a greater reality, and then through that greater reality, something had moved forward. Just moving forward in cooperation with a world they didn't know was there. And that's the generic solution to everything. I want to give you a picture because you asked me about stress. I walked out to get a rubber band and you all heard me because the microphone was on. Everybody recognizes a rubber band? Okay. Rubber band can just hang like this. Nothing's happening. You're just living your life like this. Something begins to happen, begins to pull you in a direction that you didn't really want to go. Where is the tension created? The tension is not created by this movement. The tension is created by the fact that you're pulling in the opposite direction. I mean, you can be pulled all along, but if you're not resisting, then you move. Tension is created when you want it to be different than it is. I mean, the single most important factor for dealing with whatever challenges us is that we have to deal with things as they are, not with the way we want them to be. And then we have to gradually learn that the way that they are is actually the way we want them to be. Because we are always loved and protected by a higher power. We don't know that, though, because that higher power wants more for us often than we know is possible for ourselves. Another friend of mine had a little boy who was given to tantrums, and his mother had a very simple system of dealing with his tantrums. He'd start his tantrums. He was very small. She would pick him up. She'd put him in his room. She'd close the door in his room. She'd latch it from the outside, and she would just, you know, she was not going to let him rule the household with his tantrums. If he insisted on having them, she would just isolate him, let him play it out. So he's in there screaming for a while, then it goes quiet. She opens the door. She says, "Honey, are you done?" And he looks up at her and he says, "Not quite, Mommy." And then he begins to scream more. And so she closes the door and lets him finish. And that's essentially how God is working with us. He says, "Are you ready to learn?" "No, not quite. I think I'll just keep having a tantrum for a little bit longer." Whatever that tantrum looks like. You know, it can look like drug addiction, oversleeping, television, just pure crabbiness, depression, fury at what's going on around me, anything. And God says, "Are you done?" "No, not quite." "Okay, keep it up." And then when you're ready, you can open your awareness and expand to become who this is trying to make you become. And we have to accept and understand that suffering is often, as Swami put it once, pain is often the shortest route to freedom. And if we just are at peace with that, we don't have to love it, but to accept is the first step. This is what's happening. Now, do we have any questions or thoughts about this? Yes.
Can I ask a philosophical question?
Sure.
If there's reincarnation, mm-hmm. we're all, you know, supposed to be evolving every lifetime or whatever. What's the ultimate purpose?
Well, first of all, we don't automatically evolve. Animals automatically evolve because they do not have the ego structure that allows them to make wrong choices. Their evolution is just, they're just scooted upward. Once you become a human being, you have the choice about how to direct your energy. We have a sophisticated enough ego structure. Ego is our sense of individuality to choose how we behave. So there is the force that causes us to evolve is the way we're made, which is if we're not cooperating with the highest principles that govern life, we suffer. And suffering gradually awakens us to the possibility that I don't want to suffer, and it gradually awakens us to the idea that maybe I need to put my energy in another direction. That's how suffering teaches us, isn't that so? So the ultimate point is, like, when a child is sent to kindergarten for the first time, the child may feel that the mother who's loved and protected you has just abandoned you into the hands of these strangers, and the ultimate purpose of it is utterly obscure to us. And we insist that, no, mommy, I'm going to stay with you for the rest of my life. I'm going to marry daddy and live with the two of you forever, because the child can't see where it's going. But the mother knows, because of her superior experience, what the benefit of that is. So with us, what every heart longs for: perfect love, for freedom from pain, for the ability to choose happiness. Everyone wants that. So we keep trying out, incarnation after incarnation, various systems for getting that. Now, we learn from having our desires frustrated, from longing for a perfect love relationship and not having it. We can learn that, oh, it's possible to have an okay life without it. But we learn more, and ultimately we actually have to fulfill every desire that we have, because we have to find out whether or not this is the final fulfillment. And so every desire that you have will eventually be fulfilled, and we keep reincarnating to try it. But if there are any things in your life, which I'm sure there are, that you have succeeded sufficiently to understand what it can bring you, and then still the heart is restless for something else, because we are made for infinity. And anything less than infinity does not satisfy us, if for no other reason than that moment of death comes and whatever it is absorbed back again. And so the ultimate purpose is to become what we are destined to become, which is, we have descended from infinity, we are a spark of divinity, and we need to live in that reality. So all of us will become saints and enlightened masters in time, every one of us. And in the meantime, we need to keep our eyes open and keep working. And the reason we need to do that is because it says in the Bhagavad Gita, even a little bit of right living diminishes our pain and increases our happiness. And it's in our own best interest to do so. Does that make sense? I mean, this is the promise of all the scriptures and all the masters. We can believe it or not, but we can look at the microcosm of our own little life and realize that expanding awareness, greater acceptance, courage in the face of, increasing inner freedom, the ability to choose my own consciousness, works better than the opposite of all those things. And so then you have to ask yourself, is there any limit to that? Is there any limit to how much freedom I can have, how much happiness, how much self-mastery? The masters say, no, you become infinite. We may not necessarily believe that right off the bat, but the little bit that we can see certainly leads us in that direction, doesn't it? Does that help? Any other question? There was a... I know what I was thinking about. A friend of mine, his name is Evan Strong. He's not famous, but he's accomplished in this respect. He lost his leg below the knee. He's in his 20s now. He's presently the gold medalist in one of the snowboarding events in the Paralympics. And you know, he's really quite an outstanding athlete. I first met him when he was 6 months old. He was on a blanket his mother put on the floor in East West Bookshop, not this location, but up in Menlo Park where it used to be located. I walked into the store and this child was, she'd put a blanket and he was on the floor while she shopped, and something about him really attracted me. And I went on my hands and knees and looked into his eyes, and this incredibly powerful spirit just looked right back at me. So we spent a little bit of time on the floor together. And eventually I met his mother and became engaged with this whole vast extended family, all starting from this little child on the floor. He grew up, and by his early teens, he was a professional skateboarder with just a very remarkable athletic ability and had many other interesting qualities. in his early 20s, I think, or maybe his late teens, he was riding a motorcycle in Hawaii where he then lived. He was riding perfectly safe. He was a mile from home, and a drunk driver came across the road and shaved off, you know, just clipped him in such a way. And he describes, he was his whole family was meditators. He describes just lying on the highway, and the injury was so bad, he felt his life just bleeding out, as they say. He was just bleeding out on the highway. And he just lay there, and I mean, he's an athlete already. He's already a professional athlete. And he just looked at his leg, and he knew it was gone. It was just so smashed up, his foot and all of this. And he's lying there, you know, and he has to think whether or not it's worth coming back. And it was a real moment of choice. Do I just let this body go? Because when it comes back, it's not going to be the body that I've been using so effectively all this time. But he contemplated it in that strange time zone in such a moment and decided that it was worth coming back. So by the time the ambulance came, he'd made a decision and they rushed him to the hospital. He says, you know, in this incredible state of shock and chaos, "Doc, I'm an athlete, save the knee," like that. And I guess it was possible, so they took it just below the knee. And then it was a long rehabilitation. It's not easy to come back. But he this is the philosophy he adopted. Costume is torn, but the show must go on. And then he just did everything that he needed to do, became a raw food person, all kinds of things, and eventually in the arena that he can still compete in, he has became world champion. And he just tells this story over and over again. And the film of him winning the gold medal, which of course is not as publicized as the regular Olympics, when he comes off his final run and he looks up and he realizes that he's done it, he's won. I don't know, it's so moving to me, it always makes me cry. He immediately goes down on the ground and he just puts his head down in the snow like that. And you think of it like, I mean, it, you know, it's an all-out effort and he's just exhausted. But when he talks about it later, he said he was overcome with awe, was what he said, at just what God had given him, you know, all of it. And he wasn't like, "Oh, thank you, God, for giving me the gold medal." It was the whole story, every bit of it, you know, choosing to live, losing his leg, everything. He said he was just completely overcome with awe. He said he wasn't there anymore. He wasn't in Russia winning the gold medal. He was just on his hands and knees before God. Now, that's how you do it. And think what you have after that. I mean, is that what we want? Or do we want just the comfortable ride, in which at the end of our life we're, you know, a millimeter larger? So when that wave comes, how do we respond? Do we say, "Wow, what a ride this one's going to be"? Or do we say, "No, no, no, I'm going to go into my room and have a tantrum"? The problem is, though, tantrums don't change reality. So, any thoughts? Any other thoughts or questions? Well, if we don't, then we'll be a little shorter tonight than we sometimes are. Well, you know, it is on everybody's mind, isn't it? Well, you know, even though he was a good comedian, if you looked in his eyes, he never looked happy. Just depends on how you judge people. You know, I don't follow popular culture at all. I mean, I do look at Facebook, so actually you can find out anything that's happening in the world on Facebook. And I liked that man as a comedian. But I never, ever saw either his acts, his, when he was playing characters, or on occasion, you know, you can't help but see things, photographs. He never looked happy. He never had peace in his eyes. And even the way he would act, it was hard to see where his own center was. You know what I mean? It's like he I mean, you could easily say he was manic. That's
he couldn't find his soul.
Well, he
was all over the place.
He was all over the place, always. He did not have his own center. And you have to first be standing in your own reality. Now, everything is a mixed bag. That man did so much good work and brought so much laughter and upliftment to so many people. Everything balances. It's not, God is not cruel, and karma is very fair. You know, he took what was his own troubles, but he presented it to the world in such a way that many people's lives were lifted from what he did. And so the whole balance comes out. Suicide is never a good idea, but there's mitigate. Not all suicides are the same. You know, suicide in anger, suicide out of spite, suicide to get back at someone, suicide is revenge, suicide to make someone else suffer. It's very different than despair. But despair is not necessary because it's not really the truth of our lives, but he had hard karma. Whatever it was, whatever he had set in motion about the meaning of life, it was tough karma that he was facing, and so now he has to go through this. The karma of suicide is actually very scary. The karma of suicide is you have to be brought back to exactly the same point and have the courage to go through it and go on. So the difficulty with suicide is it doesn't buy you anything. It just means that you get to try it again in another lifetime. Yeah, ouch, big time ouch. It just doesn't work. It's the ultimate, I don't want to deal with what's really happening, I just want to escape. And whatever, you know, the karmic law is very complicated because we don't remember and we can't see, so we can't see why it's fair. And we have to just try to, in the little tiny cause and effects that we can watch, you know, somebody drinks for 30 years, maybe they finally get sober, but they've so injured their body that some disease comes to them later. And it's like you can't just break the laws of health and just think that your body's going to be fine. People eat badly or don't sleep or take a lot of poisons and, you know, like alcohol and so on, and body responds in a certain way. It's just common sense. You're very unkind to everyone, and you end up alienated from people. You try to control your children and use them for your own benefit and not for their own, and they disown you. I mean, you can see cause and effect, and if you think of incarnations as continuous, but it's not so neat like that, because a person like him can be immensely expanded in certain areas but still quite confused in others. And the habit of drinking and drugs is an effort to escape from reality rather than to face it. An imaginary thought that to dull my consciousness will actually in some way improve objective circumstances. And that, of course, was what he was doing, and the karma of that is that it doesn't work. And, you know, you have to really, and he solved the problem for a while, but apparently was captured again. He's also a perfect example of external things are no indicator of whether or not you will be happy. There's a TED talk by some Harvard psychologist who says external conditions contribute at the most 10% to your happiness. And he said, I can know everything about a person's life externally and still have no way of predicting whether that person will be happy or not. Isn't that interesting? But you see, we believe the conditions will make us happy, so we work hard to get them, and only after we get them do we find out. And that's where we have to fulfill all those desires until we realize, oh, maybe my inner consciousness and who I am as a person is actually the issue. Very tough. So it's a wake-up call for a lot of people, and I pray, really pray deeply, that people will take the right lessons from it. And, you know, but And I think probably people will take some of the right lessons. I hope. You know, no soul is lost forever. Suffering is often a necessary stage to growth. And he's obviously suffered, so we hope that he'll use it now to grow. Swami Kriyananda had a very sweet way of dealing with other people's suffering. He said whenever he would see someone unhappy, he would think about the inevitable time when they would have conquered that suffering and would have realized their own potential for perfect bliss. And he would think how much sweeter that moment will be because of the pain that they're suffering now. And so he would see even the present suffering as just a stage to that bliss. And what he would then do, he was able to look at you and see your future happiness instead of your present suffering, which of course had the effect of bringing you also into that reality. He saw everyone in those terms. So his presence, that's the power of an enlightened person, is that they allow you to see yourself as they see you. And as they see you is as we really are, but we're at the moment not fully aware of it. Yeah. Anything else? All right. Thank you all very much. You know, just one last thought about him. I think the enormous outpouring of gratitude will be the outpouring of his very good karma, which is very likely to lift him through whatever, wherever he is now, faster. Because there's just been such an enormous outpouring globally of gratitude toward him and a reliving of all the happy things that he gave to people. So that vibration, that what we need to pray for is that he'll be conscious enough and willing to lift himself above what he's just done to receive that. That's what I was thinking today. So instead of emphasizing the tragedy of it, we should be projecting very strongly all the goodness that is part of him so that he himself will wake up to it. Because it's such a misunderstanding on his part of his own reality. He was a very successful human being in what he was able to give. Now he just needs to integrate that into his own reality and not just into the characters he played.
Is that something that he and we can do after death when we're in these other realms? Do
absolutely.
Continue to live like this?
Nothing really changes when you die because your ego structure, which is your individuality identified with the limited condition that you call yourself, is not affected by taking off the physical body because that ego structure is part of what we call the astral body or the energy body. That's why when people go to the other side, they just stay themselves because that identification remains. So his identification, he doesn't remember necessarily all the details. It's more like a vibration of consciousness, the sum total of everything that you've done up until now. So he's in a vibratory realm that vibrates according to what his consciousness is. Now, suicide tends to pull you into a darker place because it's such a total rejection of reality, really, and it doesn't work. So suicides go to dark places, and there's a couple of very interesting books about suicide in return, people who tried to commit suicide but didn't die, and just realizing how dark the place is that you go. This one woman killed herself, but unsuccessfully, but she died, went into this dark realm, and she said she was just surrounded by people who were just sitting in a state of despair. And she said by the look of the clothes that they were wearing, some of them looked like they'd been there for a really long time, just sitting in a state of despair. She saw herself going into that, and it crossed her mind. She wasn't a religious person, but the concept of Jesus and the name of Jesus occurred to her. And as soon as the concept of Jesus occurred to her, she literally just lifted her head. And she realized that right above that place, there were hordes of angelic beings who were all trying to reach these people and trying to just get their attention and have them literally look up. And as soon as she looked up, she saw this light, and then the power of her own capacity to have hope in that moment just lifted her up. And she came out of that darkness and also eventually just came back to her body. She didn't actually die. And so, yes, that's exactly right. So how dark he stays is really his own choice. It's a choice dictated by all the thoughts and feelings he's had up until this point. But he was obviously a complicated person. And the goodwill and the love of others can have a very strong effect on us. I mean, just think about it. If you have a good friend somewhere that you know really loves you, that those thoughts really help you. Even if you're not conscious of it, you feel it somehow. So the enormous outpouring of gratitude will be a magnetic force that one hopes will break through his despair. But a person's despair can be all-consuming if they want it to be. If you've ever dealt with anyone who's deeply depressed, and yes, it becomes a chemical condition in the brain, but the chemical condition in the brain is created by the karma. It's the karma to have that condition, and that just makes it worse. I mean, the chemical condition, your body is a reflection of the karma that you need in order to face the challenge that you're going to have to figure out. It's suffering is often the shortest route. I mean, the whole story of karma, I have countless talks on that subject. If you go onto YouTube and just type in my name, Nayaswami Asha, which I'll give you these, it's written in here, there's some very, very, very good classes all about karma, because this is a very complicated subject, but that isn't. And karma's always fair. It's always the result. It's metaphysics. It's not whim. But it's, as I was saying, it's very hard to see. This man had very hard karma, but also very good karma. He was successful. He was rich. He was well-loved by many. He did lots of very good work. He was talented.
Isn't it true that when someone suicide, then they were sent back to the reincarnate right away?
No, not at all. Whether you get, in fact, sometimes if you commit suicide, sometimes you are miscarried or even aborted because you have thrown away the opportunity to live, and so often that opportunity is denied to you. Not always, but sometimes. You know, karma is very complicated. If you didn't value your life, why would it just be handed right back to you? So you first have to reach the point, you know, where you're ready. And then sometimes you have to persevere.
Are we conscious in these other realms after we die? Because I've heard that some people, it's just as if they're asleep.
It depends how much your own awareness, how much you understand that consciousness expresses through the brain but is not caused by the brain. So if you have meditated, if you have been a creative artist, if you've been infatuated with music and beauty, if you have experienced realms more subtle than just the physical, you can lose the physical body and the ability to experience directly just physical things through the senses and still retain consciousness. If you are extremely steeped in the physical world and don't have any idea that there's any other world, when you go to the non-physical world, you can't see it. And so you are essentially asleep. The way Yogananda calls it, it's kind of a gray dream. You can either be completely asleep, and you just rest, and you don't wake up again until you're in another body. And then all of a sudden you're a kid, and this you understand. But if you've done things in your life to put you in touch with a non-physical reality, then when the physical body dies, it may be a little surprising, but nonetheless, you're not at sea. You know where you are, and you can see it and experience it. But suicide itself, you see, is an affirmation that there's nothing to live for. And you may imagine that somehow it'll free you, but it won't, because you've rejected the essential principle, which is I have the power within me to overcome anything. So yes, our prayers, our love, our relationships, that's why we have funerals and things like that. It's really done correctly. I mean, and this is why, for example, in Italy, where our community is, somebody was killed, some young man was killed on a motorcycle along the road leading to our community. And it had happened like 2 or 3 years earlier. And every day his mother went and made a little shrine to where he died and kept the flowers fresh. And Swamiji was driving by that. He said, I know other people will admire that. He said, but that kind of grief exerts a terrible bondage on the soul that's gone forward. Because he's done. He's ready to go on. And her grief is just trying to hold him to what is finished. You have to accept reality. And it's sort of like if you go off to college and you go to Europe for college and your mother calls you every day and tells you how unhappy she is. Is that love? You can miss your child, but to call every day, and you see the difference? And you can be sad for yourself and rejoice for your child and just be honest on all planes. You have to be honest. You have to be sincere. But really, you're happy your child is having this great experience. And you accept this is what motherhood is. You know, I raise him and launch him. He doesn't belong to me. I raise him and he dies. He doesn't belong to me. His soul had his own destiny. Yes, it has a huge effect. I mean, there was a woman friend of mine. Her father raised 8 children, worked hard all his life, died, you know, at a very ripe old age with all his wonderful children around him. You know, 2 years later, she's still mourning. I said, honey, give the poor man a break. What do you want from him? He gave you everything. You can love him, but to hold on like that's not fair to him. You should be grateful and then be glad that he's out of that old body and done with this project. Bless him. Let him go on. Let him head for his next adventure with your true love and gratitude, not just your refusal to accept reality.
Did she understand that?
She thought it was a very interesting perspective. Mm-hmm. I thought, what other perspective can there be?
What's the perspective when it's a baby?
Okay. The mother and the father together, sperm and ovum, and then inside the mother's body, creates a vehicle for the soul to express its destiny. But the parents do not create either the soul or its destiny. So we want to create a baby that's going to live. It's a natural term, but it's an independent soul with its own destiny. And if it dies as a baby, it dies as a baby. See, we think that's so tragic because we have this. This is where I started. This is what life is supposed to be. But that baby could have done his whole story. He was just done. He just needed to be a baby. Or, you know, maybe it's not such good karma. He could see things aren't going to work out the way I wanted them to. I'm going. It could be so many reasons that are not necessarily bad. Yogananda put it in an even more challenging manner. On the earth plane, or the material plane, because there's many planets, a baby is born, and everyone rejoices. In the astral world, they're all sad, because now the soul has gone somewhere else, gone to another plane. On this side, someone dies, and we're so unhappy. And in the astral world, they say, welcome, welcome home. This is all the death and return stories you hear, that you're welcomed, and you're very, very happy, and you're perfectly happy to be done with it. You don't feel like this is all wrong. Although sometimes always you get sent back because those are the stories you hear. But you don't think it's a mistake to have died even when you die young. That was my destiny. That was the particular lesson I needed to learn, whatever it might be. Of course, it's heartbreaking and we can't pretend that it's not. But it's not, for it to be heartbreaking is not the same for it to be tragic.
Why does Christianity not have anything about rebirth or reincarnation?
Well, the actual historical reason, which I can point you in directions that would explain it more, is that it was in there.
It was.
It was taken out. Mm-hmm. It was removed. Mm-hmm. But in Kriyananda's book, The New Path, there's a chapter called Original Christianity. And there's a chapter called Reincarnation, and he documents a lot. Now, you see, a few traces are left in the Bible.
It was a church decision. That's what I'm trying to say. It was a church decision because the church wanted to have more control over people. And they felt if you had reincarnation, it obviously lessens their control in this lifetime. So they wanted to reduce it so that they could declare that you would be damned to hell if you didn't do what they said. And if you could just go and have another lifetime, it's not going to work the same. So they took it out. But there's a few very notable examples. Jesus says to his disciples, "Who do you think I am?" And they start naming old prophets. Why would they give that answer? And then they talk about whether he's Elijah from the Old Testament. And he says, "No, Elijah has come, but they knew him not." And then they said to one another, "He's talking about John the Baptist." Now, how direct can that be? The blind man is there, and they ask, is this man blind because of his own sins, or is he blind because of the sins of his parents? Now, if he's born blind, where did those sins come from? You know, there has to be some previous existence for this to have brought him to that point. I mean, or this poor lad is evil, which is sort of what they end up trying to say. Once you take reincarnation out, nothing makes any sense. And your teaching gets very, very distorted, which, with all due respect, is what's going on right now in Judaism and in Christianity, less in Hinduism, in everything without
incarnation. Also has one lifetime.
Well, I'm happy for them if it works for them. I find it completely incomprehensible. And when I got reincarnation as a concept when I was in my late teens, I didn't like immediately understand it. But I started looking at life as if it were true. And wow, everything starts coming into order. And you begin to like, and not only is present existence coming into order, but understanding what I should do and why also comes into order. Everything begins to shift for the better. And of course, Christianity is unique in denying it. I mean, there's vast portions of the world just take it for granted because it makes so much sense. It's part of Sanatana Dharma. It's the way it's always been. And go ahead.
Was it in the early church that it was taken out?
Yes, it was about 500 years after, at a particular church conference. It was taken out, and some argued, this is what Jesus taught, but the church wanted control, and they couldn't have it if you could just reincarnate and sort it out later. I mean, think about it. Why would you have to go to Mass unless you're going to go to hell? I don't mean to be rude, but you know, so much of it is, yeah. I mean, I'm the leader of a spiritual group, and we joke a lot about, wow, I mean, I can understand how tempting it is to try to get people in line by threatening them with something like eternal damnation. I'm only joking. But you know, people are just going to do what they're going to do. And if you start down that road of control, like, where do you stop?
What do you think is going to happen with that? Because such a huge proportion of the world is Christian and they have that belief.
And all of you may depart if you like, because it's now 9:00, and I'm perfectly happy for you too. This is, but I will answer your question. This is a program guide for our temple up the road, if any of you are interested.
Do you speak every Sunday when you have services?
I speak almost every Sunday. Sometimes I'm out of town, but I speak often. And I also give Tuesday classes and Saturday classes. If you go on our website, you'll find it. And when I'm not speaking locally, wherever I am, it's filmed or recorded and posted on the internet. So you can bury yourself in my words if you wish. Thank you, ladies. So let me finish answering your question, which was, how what's going to happen?
Yeah.
Okay, once you start with the idea of reincarnation and the idea that perfect enlightenment is possible, then you must realize that there are going to be many people existing side by side who are all going to have different states of consciousness, and therefore different needs, different next steps, different karmas. So planets, and this is a huge, I'm touching on many systems. There's many planets for people to incarnate to, and planets actually have their own karmic cycles of either being a very enlightened planet or a less enlightened planet. This is an astronomical fact related to how close they are to the center of the galaxy. Okay. Planet
Earth. We're talking about our own galaxy.
Our own particular solar system within the galaxy. Our own planet Earth. Okay, planet Earth at this time is shifting from lower consciousness into higher consciousness, but it's by the nature of this planet at this time it's a mixed bag, and so lots of souls have been drawn here on many different levels of consciousness, and different ways of thinking work for different people.
But okay, and I don't mean to interrupt. But
no, that's all right.
There are other planets within our galaxy.
Oh, within our galaxy for certain.
And also, but there are also other galaxies.
There's an infinite universe.
Yeah. Other places available to us.
That's what Nityananda says. Okay. I have no way of knowing, okay. But he also proposes, how preposterous to imagine that we're the only inhabited planet in the whole system.
It's hard to imagine the other as well.
Well, we'll find out, won't we? Well, science fiction has imagined it beautifully. You know, it's in television and movies all over the place. I mean, at least they've given us lots of possible scripts of ways to think about it. There's just some.
I always thought of science fiction as being escapist, but not.
A great deal of it has been proven to be predictive. You know, if we look backwards, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea and things like that. You know, it was all imaginary when it started. Two-way wrist radios.
Yeah, right. Dick Tracy.
Well, it's been very nice to meet you.
Thank you. That was very helpful.
Okay.
I know most of those things, actually, from my own research and whatever, but it's good to hear them. And the peacefulness with which you speak was very nice to experience.
Oh, I'm glad you enjoyed here. Do take
this.
Thank you. I hope to see you again.
I think you will.
Bettina.
Yes.
I hope to see you at Ananda. That would be lovely.
Thank you. This
particular Sunday, I will be out of town.
Okay.
But the woman who's taking my place is wonderful. You'll enjoy her completely.
Thank you.
Okay. We're not all women, but it happens to be another woman taking my place.
That's okay.
All right. Good night.